to teach myself to write and to learn the English. I didn't have problem because I talk lots and I ask questions and I learned to speak English much, much faster than I could write. So that's the reason they call me, because that's what Michu want. He want the culture of the native and the connection with the animal, with the people on earth. And that's my trait. So I guess he was in the right place. He had to come back the next year. And so to close, sorry, my husband Stephen Atla is not here, and especially my son. He called him my Japanese brother. And that was always will be. And I thank you very much. And to close, I like to have a few seconds of silence, memories of my boy, Michu. Thank you.
All right, the mic is open for anybody who wishes to come forward, and more than one wants to come forward and form a line or whatever you want to do. I'm happy to hear from everyone here.
Michio was an extraordinary person. I first met Michio in the spring of 1979. We were both students at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And we were taking a class together, conservation of natural resources. And Michio, he had made a presentation in class about kayaking in Glacier Bay that he had done that summer. And I immediately, that caught my ear, because I had done some backpacking in Glacier Bay in very much the similar place that summer. And so we had that in common, and we shared and after class and got to know one another. By meeting Michio at the University of Alaska, I met all the Japanese students, and even broader, all the international students. They were like a big family. Both Michio and I were in a wildlife biology track at the time, and Michio wanted to learn more about the wildlife that he was to photograph. Michio was an extraordinary person. He was very likable. He loved to laugh, as you know, and as you have heard. His laugh was contagious. You couldn't help but laugh yourself with him. Michio was respectful. He was respectful to both his wildlife subjects and to people. A very patient man who would develop a relationship, a rapport with that wildlife that he photographed, spending long, long hours on trips. He would say that sometimes he would shoot a whole roll of film, and if he had one picture in that roll of film, he would be happy. He was respectful to people. From the very start, he was a good listener, and he would take the time to talk to you and to get to know you, and he did that with everybody around him. He was a disciplined student. Michio would spend long hours studying, and one memory is we both, I believe, had a biology exam, and it might have been a final. Michio worked at the university in a work-study program where he washed dishes in the cafeteria. And that morning, or that afternoon, when I went to the cafeteria, I passed Michio in the window where you brought your tray with your dirty dishes. And there was Michio scrubbing away on the dishes. And I said, "Michio, how did your exam go?" And his response was that he had studied all night long, did an all-nighter. And he says, "In the morning, mine don't work." He had a very capable mind. He, from the very start, he would carry a notepad in his pocket, and whenever he heard a new, and a dictionary often, and when he heard a new English word, he would jot it down on his notepad, and then he'd go back and look in his dictionary when he had time, and he loved English phrases, idioms. For example, Michio would say, "I can resist anything but temptation." Michio was caring. He was caring towards the wildlife and their needs, their habitat needs for wilderness. His love for wilderness protection, the need for that, like in Anwar. And people. Not many people probably know this, but when the summer of, I believe it was 1980 came, there was an Eskimo man who was a student at the university, was a friend of mine and a fellow friend of Michio's, who sadly, on a drunk in Barrow, killed another man and was sent to prison. He was in Fairbanks for a while, and then he was eventually sent to Oklahoma, where he still is there today, for manslaughter. And just to show how Michio cared, he made an effort to go all the way to Oklahoma to visit that man. He was an educator. Japanese youth would come. He had a strong value of the importance of educating the youth, and you heard about him with joining groups of young people at the Ruth Glacier at Mount McKinley. He was sociable. He spent a lot of time out by himself photographing, but he loved people. He often would invite people on trips. Once my family joined Michio with another Japanese family, the Kodamas, and we went to Tangle Lakes and all the way down to Kenai together, and that was a cherished memory. Another time, he invited us to stay in a little Forest Service cabin in southeast Alaska where he was going to photograph black bear feeding on salmon. And that was a joy. So he loved people. He was personable. He would take the time to, you know, how are you doing? And he really meant it. He really meant it. You know, how are you? How is the family? How are things going? He was a good listener. Easy to talk to and a warm personality, as many of you know. He was an established cook. How many of you have experienced Michio's famous curry rice? And here he would be cooking in all conditions that rice. He was a physical man, a physical in the sense of even with some of the awkwardness, Michio would lug around heavy equipment, photography, lenses, heavy packs. And when he came into town, sometimes he would enjoy playing tennis with friends or cross-country skiing in the wintertime. An incredible story was when Michio went all the way to, he flew in, was dropped off on a glacier at Mount McKinley in the middle of winter. In the middle of winter. And he told the pilot, pick me up in a month. He spent a month on this glacier. Talk about being dedicated, trying to get a picture of the Northern Lights and Mount McKinley together on the very last night the Northern Lights came out. He said it was so cold, and I don't think he wanted to repeat that trip as far as cold. He was charismatic, he had that deeper side, and always positive. And that smile, that just radiant smile. A dedicated photographer, that goes without saying. And a family man. I knew Michio when he was single. And we followed each other's lives. I transferred from the University of Alaska in 1980-81, and Michio continued on, and we continued to follow each other's lives and joy, the joy in that. And I got married and started a family, and he visited us on occasion and when he was passing through Seattle. And Michio, I could tell in words and just unspoken, that a family would be dear to him someday. He yearned for that. And with joy, we watched your relationship, Naoko, develop with Michio, and then, of course, with your son, Shoma. What a joy. So in conclusion, he was a extraordinary person, human being. A person to admire. I can't imagine myself going to Japan with a very different language and culture and starting a career and excelling the way that Michio did. I mean, that takes just an amazing person. He had a gift. He could network with people. He bridged the cultural gap. Just the way he could get along with anybody. It's a big loss. He made his mark on the earth. I feel blessed to have known him. He touched my life. And to Michio's parents, whatever you did in raising Michio, you did a wonderful job.
I would suggest when you speak to introduce yourself first, because I think this was Phil Lindahl from Seattle, former Alaskan. So if you would introduce yourselves, and also remember we have a lot of people who would like to speak, so try to make it brief and to the point so that we can get as many people up to the mic as possible. Thank you.
Well, I guess we use up a lot of Kleenex in this group this during this time. You know, Mitchell wasn't a person that you met and said, wow, what a guy. He just gradually comes into your life, and you keep becoming more and more aware of him gradually and all of his wonderful qualities that other people have spoken of. It's just one story I want to tell because I haven't talked to anybody else that's ever. We're putting together Mitchell's lives, and we're finding people from different places that knew him at different times in different situations. And one day, Mitchell came out to visit me, and I came out to visit us, and I was alone. I was sitting by the fireplace, and I'd known the story about him coming to Shishmaref and starting out life with the Eskimos, the Inuit people. And I said, but Mitchell, you went back to Japan and you got a degree in economics. How come you're in a photographer? And we sat by the fireplace and he said, well, that's a long story, and I just waited for it. And I didn't interrupt a minute while he was telling it. He said, I had a very close friend, a boy that I'd gone to school with, and he said, we climbed together a lot, and I was supposed to go with him on this mountain climbing trip. People in Japan can probably tell and fill in the blanks of what mountain it was. Anyway, evidently it was a volcano and it exploded, and this man was killed. And he said, you know, my friend's lifelong ambition was to go to Alaska and photograph wildlife. He said, then I knew what I had to do. And he said, that's why he came. My last memories of Mitchell was he had always wanted to go up in the North Country on a trip with me. I used to guide up there. And we kept putting it off and putting it off. And one day I get this call from him and he said, we go this summer. And I said, Mitchell, I'm going to be in a wheelchair before we go on that trip. He said, nope, we go in May. I said, you can't float Alaskan rivers in May. They're frozen. He said, June. All right, you pick the river. And I said, I would like to do the Shinjak because I haven't been on it, and that's the river that Marty and Olus Murray went north to look at what the southern boundaries of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge should be. And I said, yeah, I would like to kind of go on a pilgrimage for the Murrays. And he said, oh, great. He said, I know Marty. I would like to do that too. Then I thought, well, who's going to put up the food? And I said, well, Mitchell, we met at my house, and he invited Celia to go too, and another friend of ours who had been a guide up in the Brooks Range, who was also a photographer. So we had this meeting in the house. He said, what food we'd bring? He said, I don't care what I eat mostly, but on a trip I like to eat well. He said, I buy the food. I said, but Mitchell, I don't know how to cook Japanese food. He said, I do the cooking. Well, I didn't know that Japanese men cooked. And then I said, but Mitchell, I don't want to eat sushi for breakfast. And he said, we have rice. And we had rice. That was a wonderful trip. There were just four of us in a raft. And we talked a lot about we'd go ashore and climb that mountain, or we'd go up on that ridge. We never got very far. We'd just sit down under a tree and sit and talk and look and just let it sink in. And then we hiked over to the lake, to Last Lake, where the Murrays had camped, and we paid our respects to the Murrays with a big moose that was there. And I can't think of any trip I've ever been on that it was so laid back. So I knew he was going to take pictures, and I thought, oh dear, there'll be a camera in my face all the time. I don't want that in the wilderness. And You never would even know I was taking a picture, except sometimes you'd just notice he did, and then you'd look and Michio would give that little smile and a little bow. Excuse me, thank you. And he would take his pictures. I don't know what kind of a Valhalla that Michio was went to, what he envisioned in his death. And I don't think he thought about it much. But I kind of think, hope it's got a lot of wild country in it, mountains, glaciers, and there'd also be a lot of wildlife, wolves, caribou, bears, perhaps even the one that the last bear that encountered. I think if Michio met that bear, they'd have an understanding. Michio knew how to talk to bears, and they knew how to understand him. They came when he was asleep. He didn't have time to talk to this bear. And he would also have to be people. There would have to be Inuits, there'd have to be Athabascans, and because he wouldn't, even though he loved the wild country, he loved the animals, he liked people.
I'm Bill Fuller, a longtime friend of Michio. I want to thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Hoshino, for the gift you have given us of giving us Michio, who has enriched our lives for many of us. His death has given us a keener awareness of our own transience on this earth and the need to hold our friends closer to our hearts. It is this great gift of his that has allowed us to love each other more deeply. Arigato gozaimashita.
Hi, my name is Roger Kay, and I'd also like to share some of my couple memories and some impressions of Michio. I first met him on the Kobuk River just outside of Ambler. It was in September, about this time of the month, I think, and actually the first impression I got of him on that trip was not in our meeting, but it occurred about an hour before. I had just arrived, and some friends from the village, Don and Mary Williams, met me at the airport, and they told me about a very unusual visitor that they had staying with them. And on the walk to the village, and then later on the way to introduce me to him, they told me some very interesting things about him, and I don't remember much of what they said, the details, but I very clearly remember the very high level of regard that they held for him. I remember distinctly that it was just an unusual level of respect for an outsider, particularly a foreign person. And after I met Michio and was able to talk to him, and I stayed at his camp for a while, it seemed to me this affinity with Native people that Catherine mentioned and others here was probably due to his humility and his modesty, and this unpretentious manner that he had, and this. I guess, understated competence that he carried, that just surrounded him. But as I got to know him a little better on that trip, I got to see that what the Kobuk River people saw in this very unusual visitor was a person of a very deep substance, a person of great depth. In spite of the language difficulty that we had, and he didn't speak English as well at that time as he did later, but in spite of the language difficulty, you could just tell that there was this level of insight and this perception beneath the surface of this man that was just very rare. And you'd later see that level of depth and insight underneath the photos that he took as well. It soon became apparent to me that Michio had not come to Ambler just to take pictures to sell, as so many photographers had. He wasn't just seeking aesthetic and dramatic images of the caribou crossing, although he did capture that very well, of course. He sought something beyond scenic and wildlife and landscapes. It's hard to explain what that was he was seeking, but I don't think I have to. I think everyone that's looked into his pictures, everyone that's looked at the pictures around this room understands what brought him to that place. He came seeking, I guess, deeper meanings, deeper imaginings that the country embodied. And he found that. He came to capture the spirit of the place. And the Kobuk River Eskimos, who so liked him, that's what they saw in him. They're a very spiritual and a very perceptive group of people themselves. And that is, I think, what they saw in him and why he had such a strong affinity for Native people. I was later to see that in Barter Island in Kaktovik when I worked there and he was staying there. Another thing I learned about him when he was staying on the North Slope is that those inspiring pictures that we so enjoy didn't come very easily. I remember he was camping on the Congakut River for quite a while one spring in the Arctic Refuge. He came early, several weeks, maybe a month earlier than the other photographers came, earlier than any of the recreationists came, and he camped out alone. I remember there was a period of really nasty weather that we sometimes get in the spring, and we decided while we were doing a survey that we'd fly over Michio's camp and make sure he was okay. And on the way, I remember looking down at the windswept tundra. It was bitterly cold and windy at the time. And I remember thinking, I'm glad I'm not down there. But we flew over his tent and we expected that he'd be holed up waiting out the storm because we couldn't imagine anybody try to take a picture in that wind. But he wasn't there. We flew around and he was nowhere to be found. He was way out somewhere. We never did find him. But he was out with his camera taking pictures. And it made me aware of how much endurance and how much hardship went into those works that he gave us, the perseverance and the persistence and the patience that went into them. I think that probably more than any Arctic photographer, Michio didn't just wait for the right conditions, but he really wanted to experience and he really wanted to capture the Arctic in all of its conditions, in all of its moods. And of course, he did that probably better than anyone. I guess like everyone here, I can make no sense of why the Arctic that he loved so much took him when he did. When I first heard about what happened, I could only think that there's some consolation in knowing that the legacy that he left behind, that the legacy of that incredible dedication, the photographs and the books and the articles, they inspire and they will always continue to inspire people all over the world. Because from his work, millions of people who will never go to the Arctic find in it pleasure. Just knowing that it exists, just because they've seen his pictures and they've read his words, they find pleasure in just knowing that the place exists. The beauty of the wilderness and the magic and the mystery, the unseen presence that his photographs evoked, I think will stir and will continue to stir in people a willingness and a wanting to work to preserve these places that he loved. It's a fine legacy that he leaves us. Thank you.
My name is Willow Jones, and I grew up in Ambler, as well as in Sisolak. And I just have some memories that I would like to share, mostly with you, Naoko. I met Michio when I was a child, and I remember arriving with my family in Sisolak in the summertime, and I saw him walking on the beach with Bob and Carrie Yule. And I thought to myself, I wonder who he is. I thought he was an Eskimo, and I was convinced that he was just another person from that area. He fit so well into that landscape and in with the people that were there. And we went into the camp, into the tent, and he cooked a big platter of eggs for us. And I remember I was curious about why they tasted so good, and he told me how he did that, and I still use some of his cooking techniques today. But when I was a child, of course, I realized what a powerful person he was, but it wasn't until later in my life that I began to realize the extent of who this person was. And once I was here in Fairbanks, I believe sometime in 1992, and I needed a place to stay. I was kind of out of home for a month before I went back to my parents' place. And Michio had always told me that I could stay in his house anytime I wanted to. And I went to see Mrs. Nishiyama, and I told her this, and I needed a key to get in, and she'd never seen me before. And she gave me the key to his house, and I went there, and I lived there for 1 month. And during that time, Michio came home for a few days near the end of my stay there, and we had many wonderful evenings, he and I sitting in the house by the fire drinking tea. And he is someone that I've always, probably as a child, I've always thought he's the most famous person in the world that I've ever known. And I remember him saying to me one night that no matter how famous he becomes because of his photography, no matter how much recognition he received in the world, he realized, and he'd come to realize in his life, that none of those things, not his photography, his recognition, those things are not what was important when a person dies. And the only thing to him that was important to have when he died was that he had a family and a wife and children. And it just has made me very happy that he has a family. And I enjoyed talking to him about Naoko. And it was always happy for me to see someone who had been single for so long and listen to the love and the energy in his voice describing her. And I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you.
My name is Sean McGuire, and I live here in Fairbanks. I have been very involved with environmental cause since I was quite young. There are so many fronts, and the battles are endless. And although there are heroic battles that are won, there is a general sense that among most of us that we are losing the war. The wild animals and places all over the planet are disappearing at a shocking pace. The scale of the pollution and the degradation is depressing. Forests disappearing, wetlands disappearing, oceans becoming polluted. On virtually every level, the planet's health and our future itself seems to look shakier every year. But for me, and I think many of us, there is this wild and almost desperate hope that some way, somehow, the human race will wake up and face what we are doing to Mother Earth. that there will be some kind of a sea change of ideas, a revolution of values and thought. And that's where Michio comes in. Michio's work, his ability to communicate to large masses of people the beauty of nature. I have seen how people are moved by his pictures, people from all walks of life, all across the spectrum, and it gives me hope. When I visit with guests at our B&B, I will admit, at times I try to influence people in regard to the environment, very tactfully, of course, but there are always those who are not open. And that's where Michio comes in. His pictures, they're very subtle, very unconscious, and very effective. The forces that are destroying nature seem so large, so monolithic, it's hard to know even who or how to fight the destruction. It seems they have the lawyers, the PR flacks, the lobbyists. The money has seemed to have corrupted our system. The politicians are bought off. But with all that, I still have hope, because we have the Michios of the world. All those hundreds of thousands and millions of people who see Michio's work, the seeds are planted, the seeds of revolution, the importance of nature. Michio, your death seems so unfair, so ironic. Today we are here to honor you and to say goodbye. It is so hard to believe you are gone. But Michio, your life and your work will keep going. I have hope. So many of us have hope. That's that someday, when the conditions are right, the seeds that you and others have planted in your vision will help us turn away from the abyss and begin to face what we as a species are doing to the planet. Michio, your life will carry on. We will all see to that. I and so many of us want to thank you, because you have given us one of the greatest gifts in a time when so many discouraging events are occurring. You have helped us feel like there is still a chance. There's still a chance.
I wonder if people would like to take a few minutes to stand up and stretch. You've been sitting for quite a while. We'll continue the open mic, but I just thought if anybody would like to take a 5-minute break or something like that, why this might be a good time, and then we'll continue with the open mic.
A really special daddy who not only took beautiful pictures, but he wrote beautiful words, and he left us several books for kids. This is the only one that I have that's for children, that Michio took the pictures and he wrote the words, and it's a beautiful book. It's a book that Shoma will read and my girls have read, and hopefully our children and grandchildren will be able to share something that will live on. Michio loved children. The first time I met Michio, it was on the airstrip at Barter Island, in the Arctic Refuge. And I had heard he was a famous Japanese photographer. I was with my 1-year-old daughter, Robin. It was her first trip to the Arctic Refuge. And I was a little nervous because I knew the plane was going to be pretty full between all of Michio's camera equipment and all of my diapers. We almost needed a shoehorn to get into the plane. But Robin and I crammed into the back, and Robin proceeded to sit down on a pocket of Michio's backpack, and she accidentally squished the fruit that he had stashed in the pack. So that was how we first met Michio, and he was flying into the refuge to shoot pictures of caribou, And Robin and I were flying into the Achillic River Valley, and I was working on my first book, and he was working on the caribou photographs. When we flew over our first caribou, of course, I had seen them before, but my daughter never had. And Michio, I'm assuming, had seen them before. But I'll never forget, we were in Don Ross's plane. Don is back there. Robin had her nose against the glass looking down on the caribou. And Michio had his face close to hers. And I remember looking into Michio's face and seeing this childlike curiosity and this love and exuberance for wildlife and for the caribou. And he was just as excited as Robin was. Robin was she only knew a few words. She was just learning to speak. But his exuberance struck me. And I thought, boy, he'll be a great father someday. And now here we have a legacy right here in the front seat, Shoma. I just want to read the last couple of pages of this beautiful book that he wrote called The Grizzly Bear Family Book. This is a wonderful book for kids. Not only is it beautifully written, but he throws in great facts for children. He says that a grizzly bear eats on the average of 200,000 berries in one day that they've measured in Denali Park. Things like that that kids love. So he did a good job with teaching children about the bears. This picture is taken in the Brooks Range. Michio had a way of doing something that a lot of wildlife photographers don't do in their books. He really presented the animal in context with the land, in context with the wilderness. A lot of photographers don't do that. They just show the animal like a mugshot, sort of. But he was able to capture the wilderness and the animal in a very precious way. And these are Michio's words, as translated and edited, I should say, by Karen did the first translation, who's here, and they were edited somewhat, but hopefully pretty close to what he had said. One autumn day, as I was hiking through the Brooks Range near the Arctic Circle, I suddenly noticed two bears running towards me from a riverbank. Were they coming up at me on purpose, or did they not realize I was there? They appeared to be siblings, just old enough to leave their mother's care, but already powerful. Closer and closer they came, loping gracefully. My heart beat like a drum. When they were about 20 yards away, I raised my arms and I shouted, "Stop!" The two bears skidded to a halt as if in complete surprise. They stood up on their hind legs, wagging their heads from side to side, sniffing the air. I was so excited, I thought my heart would burst. Then, as if they had finally become aware of my existence, they turned and raced off in the direction they'd come from. It had been a pretty frightening experience for me, but it must have been equally startling for them. Then we go to Michio by the campfire. That night I couldn't fall asleep. The two grizzlies might be close by. Very few bears are interested in pursuing people. But still, I felt somewhat uneasy. Unable to sleep, I thought about bears, about people, and about Alaska. There's another bear. Shoma? Bear, yeah. If there wasn't a single bear in all of Alaska, I could hike through the mountains with complete peace of mind. I could camp without worry. But what a dull place Alaska would be. Here, people share the land with bears. There is a certain wariness about people and bears, and that wariness forces upon us a valuable sense of humility. People continue to tame and subjugate nature, but when we visit the few remaining scraps of wilderness where bears roam free, we can still feel an instinctive fear, how precious that feeling is and how precious these places and these bears are. Trophy hunters from the lower United States and from Europe come to Alaska to shoot grizzlies. They smile for the camera and stand, gun in hand, over the body of a dead bear. They hang their trophy on the wall, the head of a bear with its fangs bared, as if it was killed while attacking the heroic hunter. In truth, a high-powered rifle was fired from a great distance at a bear that was peacefully eating berries. Just imagine you're alone and unarmed on the Arctic plain with a bear. You and the bear feel the same breeze pass over your faces. You, a human being, are on equal footing with the bear. How wonderful that would be. No matter how many books you read, no matter how much television you watch, there is no substitute for experiencing nature firsthand. If you cannot meet a bear in the wild, then you must try to imagine it. For even if you can only imagine it, the feeling can be real, and it is the feeling that is important.
I'm Karen Colligan-Taylor, and I'd like to continue perhaps from the point that Debbie left off and talk a little bit about a new children's book by Michio. I met Michio in July of 1979 when he was making his first kayak trip through Glacier Bay. At that time, my husband and I had just moved permanently to Gustavus, and we were building a cabin. And Michio came to have dinner with us in our outdoor tent kitchen. Since that time, I've enjoyed a beautiful friendship with Michio, which has been much enriched by his marriage to Naoko. And my husband Mike and I are looking forward to having Naoko and Shoma as neighbors, both in Gustavus and in Fairbanks, for the rest of our lives. I'd like to talk a little bit about a prominent theme in Michio's new book, the equality of all life and the notion of death as the first step in the process of rebirth is the theme emphasized by Michio in his recent children's book, Nanuk no Okurimono, Nanuk's Gift, which was just released in English translation by Cadence Books. Nanuk, the polar bear, talks to an Eskimo youth explaining the beauty of the chain of life. The wind that carried away your grandfather's last breath gave it to a newborn wolf as its first breath of life. We are constantly reborn in new forms of life. Boy, you must pray for each life that you take, just as your grandfather prayed. The words of your prayer are the human words that we can hear. We are each an expression of the earth. When you pray for my life, you become Nanuk, and Nanuk becomes human. Someday we shall meet in this world of ice. When that happens, it does not matter whether it is I who dies or you. Michio found inner strength and peace in the many cycles of nature. It was very important to him not to dwell on the sadness or the tragedy of death, but to focus on the beauty of the continuity of life, and to do our part to ensure this continuity in all its diversity. The realization that diverse life forms experience the same flow of time within the rhythm of the universe is both our joy and our salvation. And now I'd like to go back to Clifford's experience with Michio. And Clifford, if I may, I'd like to quote from your response to Michio's letter. You read us Michio's letter, and when I was visiting the Hoshino household 2 weeks ago in Japan, I looked through Michio's photo album, and there was your letter, and I copied it. So let me explain the beginning here. Once as a teenager, when he was in a used bookstore in the Kanda district of Tokyo, Michio found a picture book of Alaska which included a photograph of Shishmaref by National Geographic photographer George Mobley. At that time, books on Alaska were very rare in Japan. He carried this book around in his knapsack wherever he went, to school, on errands, and so on, and he would always look at it in the train whenever he had a few spare minutes. As he was thumbing through the pages of this picture book, he felt himself drawn to one particular photograph, an aerial view of Shishmaref taken by Mobley. He decided to write a letter to someone in the village, asking if he could visit, but then the question was, to whom should he address the letter, and what exactly should the address be? And so he finally decided it should go to Mayor, Shishmaref, Alaska, America. And it reached him. Well, this is the letter that Clifford wrote back to Michio. It's dated April 11, 1973. Dear Mr. Hoshino, sorry for the delay in answering. My wife and I have talked of the possibility of your stay with us, but we must know what month you plan to be here. The month of June and July, we spend most of the time in the country tending my reindeer herd. I handle reindeer between July 10 and 15th to mark and dehorn the reindeer. If I know the appropriate date you arrive here, it would be helpful for me. Also, I could arrange your travel from Nome to Shishmaref. You are welcome to stay with us. Sincerely, Clifford Wayawana. After spending a summer in Shishmaref at age 19, Michio returned to Alaska in 1978 to study wildlife biology at UAF. And I remember reading in his one of his essays that he was so disappointed that he was just 3 points short on the English requirement to get in. And so he went to Fred Dean's office and told him all the reasons he absolutely must stay in Alaska. And Fred said, yes, indeed, I agree that you should be here. And he called the admissions office. And Michio was so excited, he ran all the way back to the admissions office and became a student at UAF. Then his diary from this fall, 1978, goes on to say, I hope to draw a map of my personal experiences on top of the blank map of Alaska. This he certainly did, and we're all the richer for it. Some 20 years after Michio was drawn to Shishmaref by Mobley's photograph, bush pilot Don Ross called Michio to ask him to meet a certain National Geographic photographer who wanted to consult with Michio about photographing the caribou migration. The name rang a bell. Looking through his bookshelves at home here in Fairbanks, Michio found the old picture book from Kanda. Delighted at last to meet the elder photographer, Michio took the old book with him, and he and Mobley reflected on how a single photo can change a lifetime. Michio's reverent attitude toward life and his photographs and essays have in turn deeply inspired people around the world. Life is always full of new beginnings. Thank you.
I'm Mike Taylor, a longtime friend of Michio's and neighbor, both in Fairbanks and Gustavus. And when we first met Michio and Gustavus 17 years ago, we never dreamed that our friendship would extend so long. But he moved in and out of our lives for almost two decades. Much of the time he was off working at Hudson Bay for polar bears, in the Arctic Refuge for caribou, in Denali for grizzlies or moose, up the Koyukuk capturing the subsistence lifestyle, at Ruth Glacier for northern lights, in southeast Alaska for humpback whales, at Point Hope for the bowhead hunt, and even in Africa in the Galapagos. He spent months in Japan working on books and making arrangements for photo shows. We know he was back in Fairbanks when the smoke curled from the chimney next door, or when he bounded up onto our deck in those bunny boots and the knit hat for a visit, always with that grin on his face as he came to the door. I remember especially his joy in announcing that he would be marrying Nalco. And again, when he shared their anticipation of the arrival of Shoma. Over hot apple pie and tea, we'd talk late into the night about favorite places, writing projects, or even just mundane affairs like house maintenance in the winter here. Sometimes I'd turn in early, leaving Karen and Michio deep in discussion about a translation project, captions for a photo exhibit, or the philosophies of Miyazawa Kenji, or Aldo Leopold. Last month, Michio boarded a night train for a new assignment. He's out there now, traveling, with camera in hand. We don't know when we'll see him again, but when we do, they'll be the most astounding photos ever of the Milky Way.
I'm Jack Hebert. I was blessed to work with Michio designing and building his home in Fairbanks. And as long as the family is still involved in that house, I want them to remember that it is and feel that it is really his home. In the design process, the relationship that you develop is a very intimate one. And I remember the day that I walked up there on the land that he had bought and saw his home in my mind's eye sitting there in the trees. It was the first time I've been with someone that saw it too. He saw the home that would be there, and we stood in the living room on the what was just the natural vegetation, and he saw the view that I saw. And as we developed the design for the home, it really was from his heart, and I just facilitated what is there. And so when each of you that were close to him goes up to that house, or those that you that love him, loved him and still love him, and visit the home and live there, think about it as really his home, and see him, and see his gentle side in that house. Imagine it as I do when you go up the driveway, that rather than a home that was torn out of the ground and thrown up to provide shelter, that it just sort of rests there magically on this earth, temporarily, like all of us, but magically, that it just sits there in the forest. And that his love will always be in that house as long as you're there.